Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sensemaking in a Changing World podcast. I'm Morag Gamble. In this episode, I'm speaking with Devon-based herbal practitioner and herb grower, educator, author, and founder of the Herbal History Research Network, Dr. Anne Stobart. Anne has two books available through permanent publications, The Medicinal Forest Garden Handbook, published in 2020, and coming out very soon is Trees and Shrubs That Heal, Reconnecting with the Medicinal Forest, including 80 plants that are profiled there, each with simple recipes of how to use them. Anne also published her PhD research called Household Medicine of 17th Century England. So back in the early 1990s, Anne joined a permaculture design course in Dartington in Devon and was inspired to cultivate more herbs for use in her clinical practice. Anne grew many of the herbs she needed for her practice in her cottage garden and on the allotment, but her and her partner wanted to grow more. So they purchased Holtwood in 2004 and transformed it from a redundant conifer plantation into a thriving medicinal forest garden. The Holtwood project was based on permaculture design and focused on sustainable cultivation and harvest of medicinal trees and shrubs. Anne has worked extensively in education, including leading a professional herbal medicine program at Middlesex University in London, and now has an online course. She's also the founding member of the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust and is a member of the advisory board of the Journal of Herbal Medicine and an honorary university fellow of the University of Exeter. Anne has published research articles on historical recipes and the history of herbal medicine and has a continuing interest in research into agroforestry and permaculture related to herbal medicine. I really hope you enjoy this deep dive into permaculture and medicinal forest gardening. The Sensemaking to Change Your World podcast is an initiative of the Permaculture Education Institute. We teach permaculture design, teaching, and business skills online to people on six continents, who in turn localize and enrich it and find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share wherever they are. I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country, surrounded by my permaculture-designed forest garden in a permaculture eco-village. Before we jump in, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to Sensemaking the Changing World on your favourite podcast app, and please do leave us a five-star review and a lovely comment, because it so does help the little bots to find this show. Alrighty, well, I hope you enjoy this wide-ranging conversation about medicinal forest gardening. To find out more information, just check out all the links that we've included here in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for joining the show today, Anne. It's an absolute delight to have you here. I've been exploring your works in medicinal forest gardens, and I absolutely love it. And it was fascinating to me that you did your PhD on 17th century healthcare. Where did that spark of inspiration come from? Because it's quite a specific thing.
Well, I suppose it, when I completed my first degree, which was in psychology, I really didn't know where I was going. So I then trained as a teacher, and I ended up in adult and further education. And to cut a long story short, I then moved down. I used to live in Liverpool, being a Londoner originally. I moved down to Exeter. And Exeter University had this wonderful program, which is a master's in women's studies. And being an out-and-out feminist, I joined up as soon as I got here. And then the tasks set in that course were very varied, looking at women's history. And I kind of latched onto the history of medicine. I was fascinated. I discovered some local archives of handwritten recipe books, and I just wanted to know, were they used? And and that set me on quite a long exploration. And I was very lucky that I was able to embark on the PhD when I was working at Middlesex University, training herbal practitioners. And I had a wonderful supervisor who was interested in the history of science. And so the whole idea of herbal history really got kind of wrapped up into a study of domestic medicine. This was in the 17th century.
Oh, fantastic. Household medicine in the 17th century. Yeah. Wonderful.
So that's based on my research.
Yeah. And are people still doing those practices in some way, or did you find that there was a continuation of this, or you're rediscovering things that were done before and bringing them into this new food forest garden context?
Okay, so there is a punchline here because I discovered that the records that still exist are mainly to do with larger households, more wealthy aristocratic households. So it's still very difficult to research what happened to poorer people and women in particular, because so much of their work went unrecorded. But so I looked very closely at letters, recipes, household accounts for a load of households that were focused around the southwest of England, and prepared a huge database of the recipes, the constituents, and so on. And I actually discovered that most of the recipes probably were not used.
Oh.
End of. I mean, it was a bit of a shock, and it still is a shock. People don't want to hear this from me when I say it. But even further than that, I discovered that the recipes that were likely to be used and recorded and shared as very valuable were ones that contained bought ingredients, so spices and more expensive items. There were a few simples that tended to get repeated quite a lot, and so it's possible that they were handed down. But in general, I think we have some very kind of mythological ideas about household recipes. And so I write about that in the book and describe the research process in some detail, trying to get to the nub of which plants were used. And actually, I think people were really poorly informed, even by word of mouth, about plants in the past, and they suffered. They suffered a lot because they couldn't do much about illnesses and the like. So to answer your question, yes, we do have lots of history around herbs and the like, but some of it's pretty suspect because it's kind of wishful thinking, romanticism about herbs. And while I was doing the research, I got together with other herbal practitioners, because I'm a trained herbal practitioner, and we set up the Herbal History Research Network to try and encourage more scholarly approaches to the research.
Mm.
And, still exists,
the Herbal History Network. What are some of those main herbs that you found that actually were used commonly? And what are some of the myths that that you busted?
Okay, well, in the research, I found that the recipes were about 80% plants and then otherwise minerals and animal parts. And I've put it in the book, the ones that came out as most popularly mentioned, but they weren't really simples. Mm. There were occasional plants that got quite, became quite famous, like elder, because they had a particular interest in the households. There was one member of a household who had a swollen neck glands, scrofula, which was basically down to tuberculosis infection. And the elder was recommended by some people as a treatment for that. And so recipes got spread around because they were thought to help. In this case, these were herbs that dried up the nasty secretions issuing from ulcers. And then there were other herbs that were spread around, for example, cures for rickets and such like. But I don't think I could really pick on any one particular, except for possibly roses.
Mm.
The reason being that one householder, Mary Clark, who was a very interesting, forthright lady, she gave her children rose syrup. And it's still not totally clear whether it's rose leaves, which were rose petals, they called them leaves, or rose hips. But it's likely that the vitamin C produced a laxative action, and so it was thought that rose was clearing for toxicity in children, and reduced diarrhea type problems. So in that case, we don't know the parts properly. We don't know what problems, when they were given, why they were given, but they were very popular and they probably worked for reasons that were not clearly understood. Mm. Today, we would think of roses as astringent, not as laxative.
Yes, that's right. But so we there's still a whole talk about lot them of things as being vitamin C, though, don't we? I mean, that is true, is it? The roses have lots of vitamin C in them.
Yes. Yeah. So the action may have been to do with the vitamin C, especially if it was rose hips.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
which are higher than oranges apparently in vitamin C, and so just investigating. I mean, it's very difficult to find the evidence, but that's what I was after anyway, was to find corroborative evidence. And of course, women who collected herbs and brought them to the household for sale at the front door, or probably the back door, were rarely recorded in the counts, but they occasionally pop up. So you do get other, particularly flowers, collected as well. Mm. And the folklore traditions don't appear in the recipe books an awful lot.
No, that's fascinating. Gosh, wow. That's so interesting because, you know, there's a lot of information out there and it's hard to know, you know, what is actually useful and what is real. And it's really interesting to hear this work that you've been doing. But you've recently, it's about to come out. The title of the book is Trees and Shrubs That Heal. So in this book, you're really focusing, I understand, on looking at a forest garden approach, but you also had a previous book, The Medicinal Forest Garden Handbook. So taking the research that you have and then blending it with, you know, actually transforming landscapes that heal, healing the planet and healing people, what does that start to look like, and what are the kind of plants that you are incorporating and encouraging people to grow as ways to help common conditions and help to keep people healthy?
So, as you probably gathered already, I've got a fairly rigorous approach. I'm a sort of a bit of an evidence seeker, but of course, sometimes the evidence is not easily found. So, actually, although my first book, the design book, was really all about the experience I gained in setting up the medicinal woodland, Holtwood, which I can talk about more, but the experience of writing about the design, people wanted to know, as you were asking, which shrubs, which is the one that you would recommend to plant. Mm-hmm. So I felt, and I had a lot of material about how these trees and shrubs particularly could be used. And I was always very frustrated about the herb books around, that they're mostly about sort of twee herb gardens. And they're wonderful in their own right, but I wanted to look up and see what else was available. And we did a lot of sort of pollarding and coppicing at Holtwood. So I learnt about some of these trees that I was planting. So I wanted to write a book that told people about the magic of medicinal trees and shrubs, but I wanted to explain the magic. So in the book, I have not put a lot of history and folklore and so on. Other people write about that really well, and it's not really my place. And instead, what I've tried to focus on is what do these plants really do? We've got a bit of an idea from tradition, Chinese traditional medicine, North American traditions as well as European and UK traditions. So what I've tried to do in the book is to provide some introductory material which puts the plants in their place. So, and I've done it by herbal action. So all of the astringent properties of the trees and shrubs, their leaves and so on, and all the antioxidant properties from the fruits and so on. And I've tried to write about how they can benefit health. So I suppose my answer to the question again, which trees, is, well, you could use this one, for example, for an astringent, you could use oak for wonderful body washes and all sorts of external uses. But actually, what about this lovely ornamental Asian forsythia plant? The flowers are fantastic. They're astringent and antiseptic, and they can be used for soothing a sore throat or for a, again, for a face wash and the like. So I've it's a bit of a melting pot book. I've got 80 trees and shrubs, and I've managed to get them all into that framework of different herbal actions.
Fantastic. And I wonder if there's also a recommendation too of ones that would go really well in, say, smaller, tiny gardens, so people can create, you know, mini forest garden, medicinal forest gardens if they don't have the space. So is there some that you think that are really good for that kind of urban context?
Sure, yeah. I'll probably start doing some blogging later in the year once the book is out, to try and sort of draw attention to different site requirements. But the smallest plant in the book, which is technically a shrub, is partridge berry, which is a wonderful North American little sort of ground covering. It's, you know, just a few inches tall, and was traditionally used partly for astringent and antiseptic effects in childbirth and related kind of women's complaints. So that's one. There are a number of other plants. I mean, eucalyptus trees are huge, and so I've been trying to find cultivars or varieties or species that are somewhat smaller, and latched onto the snow gum, which is a smaller eucalyptus, and we started to grow it at Hotwood to try it out.
How did that go? Did it go all right then?
Well, it's very slow growing.
It's a very slow growing.
I didn't produce a huge amount of material, but all of the eucalyptus trees are so wonderful in the leaf matter that they produce is fantastic. But there are other, because the eucalyptus are the myrtle family, and there are other trees in the myrtle family that are fantastic. In fact, common myrtle, it does really well here in southwest England, and it will do well in sheltered sites. So as global warming, unfortunately, hits us, it's one of those that I would be looking to. And it has wonderful aromatic leaves, beautiful flowers, which are great for celebrations, and wonderful berries as well, which are edible. But it's the aromatics that interest me, because it can be distilled and it can be clipped like a hedge into any shape you like. So one of the things that I've tried to do in the book is to identify some of the variations of families that have particular characteristics that can be used in different contexts, particularly smaller. I'm aware that smaller gardens is a bit of an issue for people. They don't have that much space here.
Yeah. Have you come across any that are good as soap? I keep getting this question because I talk about soap nut trees, for example, and people say, yes, but they come from, you know, the Himalayas, and they're disrupting that. I'm always looking for plants that were used as soap. I know it's not medicine, but I just wondered if you'd come across any on your way.
So it's quite interesting that, because, of course, when you make soap, you use sodium hydroxide for alkali, and then you add oils, and it's the whole sort of process of combination. So you could infuse any plant matter, leaves and whatnot, in the starting material, but the chemicals are so powerful that they tend to denature everything. And what we did at Holt Wood, because we had masses of willow, was we ended up stirring in dried powdered willow as a exfoliant into soap.
Yeah.
So that, because sometimes you get soap with oatmeal and other things like that, and that seemed to work quite well, except some people find it a bit strange having little grains of brown in their soap. So not everybody likes that. But in general, I would avoid using citrus in soap, because it denatures so much. So it's sort of looking for the less reactive essential oils, perhaps the lower key odoriferous smells that might be appropriate. And because we've sold Hotwood, we don't produce the products anymore, but I think that's a really interesting area that you mentioned to explore more. There's lots of potential. One of the things I'd really like to do is do more working out how to use infused herbal waters in making shampoos.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that's one of my kind of bucket list of things yet to do. So, because there's lots of saponins in some plants, like horse chestnut and the like. And they could be perhaps made in, I put a recipe with every one of the 80 trees and shrubs. I put a simple recipe, and I can't remember which one it is now offhand, but you can make a soapy lather with something like horse chestnut because of the saponin content.
Great. I can't wait to check out all those recipes, because it's fascinating, and it's there right in front of us. And how you talk about adding these medicinal and really fantastic household uses into our forest gardens, you know, expanding it from this sense of it being, you know, chop and drop for the soil and food for us and food for the wildlife. There's this other dimension that I think hasn't necessarily been talked so much about in the permaculture world. And I find it fascinating. It's one of the things I love. I often go out and give talks in local community centres and libraries and garden groups. And one of the things I love is the bit afterwards when everyone comes up and says, oh, I use this plant for this and I use this plant. That's when all this kind of knowledge sharing happens. And it's so fascinating. There's so much knowledge about plants that's held within families, I think, that it, you know, bringing that into a book that we can share with recipes.
I mean, some people might think they're almost too simple. Very basic recipes, just because I want to get people started.
Yeah.
One of the online courses that I've been running, I got a bit of feedback from someone to saying, your course got me started on making things, and I'm really looking forward to making many more. And that's just the sort of feedback that I like to see, that once people try out a few things, for example, apples. I mean, who knew? Apple leaves can be made into tea. Well, once you start to harvest tree leaves, then the world is endless possibilities.
Can we talk about tree leaves a bit more? Because this is something that I absolutely love. I mean, I talk, like here in my garden, for example, I have mulberry leaves, and so I use them as a tea, and there's also the olive leaves. I use them too. There's lots of leaves all through my garden. I actually did a whole series of little YouTube clips about them when the pandemic was in full flight and people were finding it hard to get out and get food. And I was saying, just have a look in your garden. Let's walk around. And we did that. But the kind of trees, I didn't know about the apple trees. So for your climate, I wonder what other edible leaf, because that all of a sudden your mind just goes kapoof. There is so much food around us all the time. We just walk past.
So there's two things really. One is it's great to be able to preserve some of these leaves. So it's quite important to think about a drying facility somewhere in your house, whether it's drawers or a loft or hanging baskets, whatever, because it's very frustrating just to try things fresh. And very often drying seems to concentrate the flavour. So, for example, what did I dry? I've just ordered a dryer that's supposed to arrive today, so I'm really kind of, yay.
Is that like one of the multiple stacked cabinets?
Well, I made my own when we had hot wood, a big thing based on baker's trays, which worked brilliantly. I used a fan from a computer to get air into it and a puppy blanket warmer to warm the air. And so this homemade version worked really well, but it's too big now because I'm sort of semi-retired, if as it were, just writing and doing talks and such like. But so that's one thing that I think people don't always have and would be good to think about. But the second is, I really love tree leaf combinations, and this is where the trees and shrubs come in, because of course every single rose family member, raspberries, blackberries, right up to the apples and cherries, all of those leaves are quite astringent. I love combinations. I like to combine an astringent with something that's a bit more aromatic. So that's where maybe the myrtle comes in, or mint for the aroma, rosemary, those sorts of things, although they can be a bit overpowering. And then I like to add something a bit medicinal. So, for example, there's always the ground level herbs like yarrow, great for urinary problems. And then plants that can be somewhat more digestive, so quite bitter plants. So I'd maybe add three herbs together to make a tea. And when we were running courses in Hot Wood, we would walk about with people and just literally pull leaves off trees and then come back and put them in a pot and brew them up.
Oh, nice.
And people would be sitting there saying, gosh, I never knew tree leaves could taste this good. I think sometimes it's an acquired taste, and I would never want people to drink stuff they don't like. But you probably experience this, that bitterness is a very individual thing, and some people do like bitter tastes.
And so can we just talk about bitters? Because it's something that I think in our society we've pushed quite aside to the detriment of our health. What's your take on that, and what are some of those ways that we can reintroduce the bitters into our system? Well,
this is a bit of a hobby horse for me too, because there's so much bitter potential in bark, and I'm a bit mad about bark as well, because trees and shrubs are so productive, especially if you're coppice and pollard. It's very, very straightforward if you're able to manage them in a garden or other sites, to get large quantities of bark. And so I've always been very interested in the buckthorns. We have two native buckthorns in the UK. The purging buckthorn, which gives you an idea of what it does. Yes. It's so bitter that it's probably not safe to take. It causes a lot of griping and stuff. The other buckthorn is the alder buckthorn, which is the most beautiful little tree. We have one in our cottage garden, and it's just buzzing at the moment with bees and other insects. Seems to be full of tiny nectarful flowers. But the bark of the alder buckthorn, which is Frangula ulnus, is supposed to be aged for a year, and then it is an excellent laxative. Mm. So that's the kind of thick end of the wedge, if you like, the laxative detoxing action. But then more at the other end, then there's the bitterness of all of the daisy family, which is excellent for stimulating the digestion. And so if you overbrew chamomile flowers, that bitterness is great because it gets your digestion going, that slight edge. Yarrow, I always think of as a supercharged chamomile. So from the bark through to the ground level, we've got bitters to suit every situation. And I think in a world where detoxing is sold as a commercial possibility, we could do much more just for our self-help, improve our health by clearing the body through from these regularly produced wastes just from everyday living.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, as you were talking about the buckthorn, how do you get the bark off those in a way that's not damaging the plant? Is it you take it off the cuttings that, you know, when you coppice it, or what's the process of collecting bark?
So bark on mature trees is kind of thick and rigid and grooved and brown and not much use. So we want the bark from younger trees or branches, maybe 2 or 3 years old in the case of willow, 1 or 2 years old. Other trees, maybe a few more years. So they're ideal for coppicing cycles and just pruning branches. I've just been pruning. I've got a beautiful fringe tree, Cynanthus virginicus, which is a member of the olive family, in the garden. And I know that the roots are great as a gallbladder remedy. And I'm thinking, aha, perhaps the bark. So I've just been pruning it because it fell on my chasteberry and greenhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And so quite often branches need to be taken down for all sorts of reasons, safety or otherwise. And then what's needed is a knife which has a bit of a curve on it. I did design one, which I called the Stobie, which I'm
thinking about. You designed one, did you say?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'll send you a copy of the picture. But it was handmade, so it's quite pricey. But it was actually based on a carving knife, which had a sort of a curve to it. And a bit of a curve is ideal for thinner branches and always cutting away, health and safety, In the spring is the best time when a lot of pruning is done, but it can be done at other times of year. And if you're cutting 2 to 3 year old or younger branch bark, you can strip it off and put the strips in a paper or cloth bag and give them a shake every now and then, and they'll dry really well just indoors, and they'll keep for years. Putting the bark, getting the bark off in strips in that way, it means that then you've got just a ready-made bark for making teas and the like. So, for example, I harvest ash bark. Although we have this awful problem with disease of ash here, there are some ash trees that are okay. And ash bark is brilliant for arthritis. So, and it grows really well as a coppice. So I save ash bark peelings, and I put them into a mixture with nettle and rose as a sort of getting rid of joint pains tea.
Wonderful. I was wondering, I live in a subtropical environment, and one of the things that I battle with when I'm saving anything is mold. And I wonder whether in a moister environment like yours as well, that's an issue. How do you make sure that you dry things properly so that they store well for a long time?
Yeah, it is drying is a big issue, actually. And it's an issue for if larger scale producers, small holders and the like, want to produce herbs for sale, because they've got to have somewhere where they can dry and store effectively for safety's sake. But in our cottage, we have a cob cottage, so it's made of manure and straw, and it's quite old. But the moisture level is quite high. I think it's often 60% easily, just every day. And so getting things to dry, because of course you want moisture to get down to about 10 or 15%, is very difficult. And it's also quite difficult to find something that measures that moisture accurately, apart from the SNAP test. Does it crumble?
That's
right.
Well, that's always quite good.
But there is a way forward, which is that if you dry things until they seem to snap, and gentle warm air is the best that I've found, then once those things are dry, you can package them in paper and then put them in a big plastic barrel. And that is a way to keep things properly dry. Or otherwise they have to be processed, because they won't last. But in general, dried things don't last for more than 12 months, really.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you too, you mentioned before about the, when you dry things, that it concentrates the active ingredients. I'd always wanted to ask someone who had knowledge about this. Something in my brain says when you dry things, you actually lose some of the living qualities of it. So where does that sit? Like, do you lose something but concentrate something else? Or do you understand what my question is? I'm not sure what I'm asking.
So, again, I think a lot of the tradition is around dried herbs, because that's one of the best ways people in the past had to preserve. And things like freezing and so on are quite new possibilities, and we don't really know how that works. But my interest is really good drying. Yes. So good practice in drying then preserves the most active ingredients. And it, when you see herbs for sale in a shop and they look a bit brown in the bottles and jars, you know, don't buy. That's what you want to do is dry gently. So really, heat is not the key. If you heat herbs, then they will start to denature. And you tend to lose the active, as particularly the aromatic ingredients. But if you can blow air across them, I mean, I like to use pillowcases. I bundle everything into the pillowcase, and pillowcases have this really useful, I don't know if they do the world round, but they have this really useful flap.
Oh, yes, can put, we do have the flap too.
On a hook or a stick. Yeah. And then as I go past, I give them a whack.
Yeah.
And it bundles up all the herby stuff inside, and they're cotton, so they can be washed.
Yep.
So that's a really great way to dry just at room temperature.
Yeah.
And then pack up in glass or paper.
Yeah.
Always add it. A number of times I've dried things and forgot to add the label, and then had to chuck.
Before we go and talk about design, I wanted to ask you another question that I get asked a lot when I'm talking to different groups. It's about, you know, the safety of different things, because we're so disconnected from plants. And as kids, a lot of people say, don't eat little berries, don't eat this, don't eat that. And there's this fear there. How do you know, like when you're making your home herbal remedies, what's a safe thing? Like, can we harm ourselves as well? How do you educate around that?
Yeah. We need to avoid experimenting when we don't know what we're doing. And just recently there's been newspaper advertising in the UK of a story about hemlock being found on a road on the way to school that children walk past, and horror. And of course this hemlock's been there for years. Yes. And it's everywhere. It's a beautiful looking plant. It's very ferny and so on. And I would absolutely go with the view that we need to educate people so they can identify plants. And the carrot family is a particularly good example, because there are some toxic members alongside the sort of edible versions. And I always, when I'm doing talks and walks, warn people about that particular family, because it seems particularly problematic. But the thing is that in the past, there's been a lot of observation of what are safe herbs. So generally speaking, traditional recommendations that survive to today are pretty safe, because just by experience, we know that they're safe. We also know that herbs are very difficult to measure exactly in terms of their ingredients. There's a lot of variation through seasons and the way they're prepared and so on. But in general, they're very weak. And if in doubt, for example, many of the recipes in the past for things like wrist plasters would be used externally on the body. So, and maybe only 10% of the active ingredients would have been absorbed then. So using externally is a good way to go. So I have quite a lot of thoughts about health and safety, but essentially they boil down to education.
Yeah.
That people need to learn about the plants. And we have these lovely forest schools here in the UK, and I think they're quite widespread now. And I'm really quite keen. One of the things we did at Holt Wood was to have a training session for forest school leaders.
Great.
Where we could talk about health and safety in relation to health and medicine ideas. Mm-hmm. What we don't want is to have children going out not knowing what's safe and what isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great. Well, thank you for clarifying that. There's one other question on that health and safety. What's your take on comfrey?
Okay, so comfrey's full of pyrrolizidine alkaloids, and particularly in the root. So when I was first training as a medical herbalist, we used to use the root to make an ointment. And some herbalists still do, because it's used externally, it's relatively safe. But generally, they're pretty bad for the liver. And so I would only use comfrey leaf nowadays to make the ointment, and I would only recommend it for use externally.
Yeah.
But since comfrey is also a wonderful fertilizer plant, there's lots of other uses for it, so we don't need to completely chuck it out.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. It's I have it a lot in my garden, but there's always lots of questions about it. And thank you for clarifying that. Wonderful. So you, Holt Wood, you transformed a conifer forest into an edible and medicinal forest garden. Can you tell us a little bit about what it looked like and the process that you got to do it, and why you did it? Like, what was your motivation for taking a piece of land like that, and how long did it take? Lots of questions all bundled up in one. Sorry.
I'll try to remember those. So I trained as a medical herbalist. So I had a bit of a career in adult and further education, managing programs. And meanwhile, I trained as a medical herbalist. And as I went along, I found it really odd that so many of the herbs that I was buying for my dispensary, like hawthorn, berry, tincture, I mean, hawthorn hedges, there's millions of them in the UK. And yet the hawthorn berries were coming from, I think they were coming from Eastern Europe. And I just couldn't kind of put it together really why. And I started to learn to make a lot of my own tinctures and the like. And I thought, well, can't I grow them as well? So I got in my head that I wanted to be able to harvest particularly trees and shrubs. And then my partner Kay and I, we discovered there's a lot of small woodlands for sale in the UK, which are sort of broken up from larger woodlands that have been sold off. And we discovered this hectare of Sitka spruce in North Devon, and it'd been up for sale for, I don't know, 5 years. Nobody was interested in it. But when we actually went to look at it, we walked down a hill through the spruce and we discovered at the bottom was a meadow leading onto the River Torridge. Mm. And just straight away we thought, great, let's buy it. So we grabbed the money somehow and bought it with the idea that we would gradually fell these conifers. There are about 1,000 Sitka spruce.
Oh my gosh.
They were all very neatly planted in rows. I think it had been an insurance company investment in the 1960s. So they're about 40 years old. Anyway, so the idea was to gradually fell those trees and replant. As it turned out, it's not that easy to just fell a few trees. It's actually easier to have help from a friendly contractor to clear the lot. And we ended up with a bomb site full of Sitka spruce stumps. And then the story sort of unfolded from there. And a lot of the experience is in the book, The Medicinal Forest Garden Handbook. And I think somewhere I have an archive. I'll have to check. If I haven't, I'll recreate it about that process. So now, which bit of the question have I not answered yet?
So from the bomb site, how long did it take for you to actually create the forest garden, and what was sort of the starting points in that transformation?
So by that time I was living in Devon and I had done some permaculture training. And so I was fascinated with the idea of particularly edges. And so I kind of did a back of the envelope design, splitting this hectare up into about a dozen sort of rectangular spaces, with the idea that round the edges of all these little planted tree plots would be introduced trees. I was very interested in North American trees particularly. And then I could harvest them for use in my practice. And I did actually go, there's a wonderful organization in the States, United Plant Savers. Mm-hmm. And I did a 6-week placement with them when I took retirement from the university job, and learnt a lot more about those beautiful North American trees, where the United Plant Savers are trying to make sure that they are sustainably harvested. And so I was able to look for trees, not just native trees, oak and ash and willow and birch and so on, but also introduced trees ranging from the snow gum that I was talking about earlier, the smaller eucalyptus, through to Virginian witch hazel, which is North American, prickly ash, Xanthoxylum species from North America and so on. And so we had some wonderful help, volunteers, and we started to plant up the bomb site area. We got it fenced to stop deer coming in, which is just about feasible to fence a hectare.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you could do it for larger areas. And it grew. It grew like Topsy.
That was how high did you have to create the fencing system to keep
them? 2 meters high is the minimum in the UK, because we've got three types or more. We've got red deer, we've got fallow deer, we've got muntjacs, we've got so many, and they all nibble everything. But so the idea was that these sections, that they would be coppiced and or pollarded bit by bit, and could move around harvesting the produce. As it turned out, the trees just grew so rapidly, particularly at the lower parts where there was a lot of moisture from the meadow and river, the willow and cramp bark and so on. They just grew like topsy. So in the end, there was no way of keeping up with the coppicing regime.
Can you say a little bit of the difference between coppicing and pollarding?
Yeah, so coppicing is cutting at the base, and pollarding is cutting at, usually willows here would be, meadowside willows would be pollarded quite low at maybe a metre high. And then a lot of pollarding in Europe is done more at sort of 5-6 foot high.
Have you tried any hedging as well on your site? Do you work with hedging methods or any other more traditional ways of managing trees?
So I didn't try it at a Holt Wood, but I have been talking with other organic growers about ways that medicinal trees and shrubs could be cultivated and for commercial use here. For example, there's so many miles and miles of hawthorn hedge. It seems madness that they can't be harvested in this country. There's no tradition. And other plants could be readily used in this way. But there's an issue about how hedges are managed here, because many hedges are cut, sometimes by flail, which is quite violent, most years. And, of course, hawthorn only produces flowers and fruit on 1 year or older shoots. Yeah. So it would be necessary to look at the way that hedges were managed. It seems to me that there's lots of potential, because a hawthorn is used here because it's very easy to grow, and it's stock proof and it's quite thorny. So many of them can be, it's like a mini-arky type of forest. But it would need to a bit of a study, I think, to look at maybe with some sympathetic farmers or smallholders, why couldn't they cut each side in alternate years, and so then they could get the fruit in some way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of potential. We don't have to kind of rely on traditional methods. We could be looking ahead and thinking about what do the plants actually need to produce.
And so in terms of there's quite a rewilding movement going on in the UK as well. And how does what you're doing and advocating for here fit with that rewilding context of turning, you know, UK's land back to more, you know, wild spaces for biodiversity? And I don't know if I fully understand the controversy around the rewilding that's going on as well. So I don't know whether I've misunderstood anything, but you could hopefully clear up my my understanding of what's going on.
So I think that there's a bit of a myth about rewilding, that you just leave land to regenerate naturally. But the original rewilding projects that have sparked off interest, like Isabella Tree in southern and her farming setup in southern England, they actually managed that process. They cordoned off areas, they stopped animals from going into certain areas and so on, and they had to kind of negotiate with neighbours and walkers and so on. So I think rewilding is slightly a bit of a misnomer. I mean, the other problem, of course, is when I've approached members of the Woodland Trust and other tree planting initiatives, that there's been very much a focus on native trees and shrubs. And quite rightly, there is an interest in making sure that the sort of flora and fauna match up here. So I suppose my view would be, well, that's great to see rewilding, but well-established forests here have a fairly limited array of medicinal possibilities. And so what interests me more is recognising that we do interfere with the landscape. We do want to manage our growing areas. And also some plants can be quite invasive. For example, Buddleia. I've just written a blog on my website for the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust about Buddleia. And I discovered that one flower spike of Buddleia may contain 40,000 seeds.
Oh.
And so although it's called the butterfly bush and very welcoming nectar-wise for bees and butterflies, it's actually not a good plant because the caterpillars can't eat it here. So it doesn't really help the wildlife in the way that people might think it does. So the important thing is to deadhead that plant. You can have it so long as you deadhead it, don't let the seed spread. So that's the kind of management that I'm talking about, is within sort of fenced or limited areas that we can grow medicinals that we really want to see. The right products.
Yeah, I was going to say, imagine though that by doing the plantings the way that you're doing them and bring in that diversity of layers and niches and all different foods, that the biodiversity is naturally increasing on your site. And did you map that at all or notice the shift and change from, you know, the spruce to when you left the site?
Well, the problem is it's difficult to measure because as this global catastrophe of climate change has come upon us, it's been so noticeable that there's been a massive drop in diversity out there in terms of birds and insects. And our garden is a miniature permaculture project here. And so we do have birds and insects and butterflies, but still the numbers have dropped. And I think one of the reasons is that the plant material, the habitats, is very piecemeal. So next door's garden is quite bare, and the same with fields. I think you mentioned hedges earlier. And so if we could start looking at ways to join up those habitats, then we might begin to reverse some of this decline. If we could join up more habitats, then we actually give the insects and wildlife a bit more of a chance to prosper.
Yeah. And I was just asking too about, do you find that the general movement in your country is tending more towards regenerative approaches? Do you find there's more support for that? Has there been a shift? Because I know there's been different agricultural bills come in and different support for expanding that approach. Are you seeing that on the ground yet? Do you get a sense that there's a culture shift happening?
Yes, there is. We've had sort of ecological arguments on the Archers and Farming Today carries things, Country File, our TV program on Sundays, visits places that are doing good things. But it's pretty hard going, even though there are changes afoot in terms of funding, which will hopefully pay farmers for what they call public goods. Mm. It's kind of difficult to get the messages across because people want to know exactly how to do it. They want to be told what to grow, how to grow it. And there's still a lot of experience and experimentation to be gathered about what are the best ways. Yeah. And I think that it's an evolving process. And we do have a really good band of organic growers in this country. And there seems to be sort of, not silos, but some separation between being organic and being agroecological and being permaculture. Mm-hmm. They're not all... they do have a lot in common, but they're not all totally at one.
And but you do have the Oxford Food Festival, the Food and Farming Festival, which to me seems like a great idea because all those different groups are coming together. At least there's a conversation going on.
But notice that it runs at the same time as the official Oxford Farming Conference, which is where all the big landowners are.
Oh, I didn't know that. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, there's probably a lot more that could be said about the actual how the economics of farming works here. But I discovered this up close when I tried to work with organic growers and colleagues in promoting a herb market, because although there was a huge amount of interest and people were saying, what shall I grow? What shall I grow? And how do I dry it? And so on. The problem arose that we couldn't get buyers in the firms that use these plants to commit. And some of them would say, oh, well, we'll buy any if you've got some left over after harvest. But no grower can commit land on the off chance that they might. So it was like a lottery. I mean, people can't plant trees on the off chance that they might be of value at some point. So we do need some more kind of well-funded projects to prove that some of these approaches could be used in a more commercially sustainable way.
Yeah, great. Tell us more about the trust and what you're working on with the trust.
Okay, so it's very much, the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust is a bit of a fledgling organisation, but during the pandemic, we decided that we needed to move on from the medicinal wood, Holtwood, and it was sold at the time. And so I went online, and so there's a website, and I started, because Holtwood had become very popular, we were running courses, and they all had to be cancelled, the money was refunded. So I went online and tried to recreate those courses. So the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust is kind of a focus, if you like. I try to do a monthly blog about particular trees and how they might be used, or places I've visited and such like. And what I want to do is to highlight examples of where medicinal forest gardening is going on. And the idea really is just to spread the word of the possibilities. We've also got a little shop where we can sell a few things.
Fantastic. And the book that you've got coming out later this year.
Yeah, it's coming out October 2023.
Yeah.
And it takes the previous 40 trees and shrubs that were in the Middleton Forest Garden Design Book and adds another 40 that I wasn't able to squeeze in last time. And there's still a bit of information about cultivation and other uses, so that it may be useful for permaculture growers to see how it would fit into the context of a forest garden or a some sort of project. Mm. And as I was saying earlier, there are recipes with each species. So the idea being that there's plenty of information to select for different sites if you want to grow, but also perhaps foragers and forest schoolers might be able to use it, looking at trees and shrubs, not just in local woodland, but also in gardens and parks, because there are plenty of ornamentals in the UK coming from Asia, Australasia, and North America particularly, which can be used. And the introductory chapters are mainly about how these plants might be used, giving people the possibility of substitutes. Mm-hmm. So once you know what you're looking for, say you're looking for astringent action, maybe then there's an alternative if you can't find a particular species of plant.
Oh, fantastic. And I love the way, you know, that it's a global, like people will be able to pick it up from lots of different places with across that kind of climate zone and be able to see all those uses. And I, you know, that there's a lot of things that are in and around our gardens wherever we look that are possible. So having that is absolutely amazing. I wanted to ask you just quickly. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say they're all temperate plants, and so they would all be suitable in a temperate context.
Yeah, fantastic. I was going to ask you a little bit about your writing process as a final question, because I, as part of this writer series on Sense Making a Changing World, I'm always fascinated by how writers actually structure their thinking and manifest books. I'm always so curious also personally, because I've got lots of little book ideas that keep on swirling around my head, but I never actually find the time to make the discipline of doing it. So what was your process of actually writing your third book now?
So there's two sides to this. One is getting someone interested in publishing it. And the other side is actually writing it. So the other side, the actual writing is, I my background is in sciences, so I'm a report writer. I don't have much artistic ability. So for me, writing is very often a case of getting a load of notes, putting them together on the computer, then printing them out and looking at them and thinking, oh my God, that doesn't make much sense, and scribbling all over it and then going back to the computer. So it's a evolving editing process. The key being that I end up with far too many words. Like I remember with my research thesis, I ended up with twice as many. I think usually you produce about 100,000 words. I ended up with over twice as much. And then trying to reduce that is a bit like cutting off arms and legs. Mm-hmm. But the key to that is what am I trying to say? And I talked about the research, historical research that I was doing earlier. And I thought then the two things I wanted to say was, this is how you could consider researching recipes in context. And actually, when you do, you find that surprising result. Maybe they weren't used so widely after all. And similarly, I've had to focus on the what am I really trying to say in a nutshell. And then that helps to prune and focus. And I'm very much in favor of the introduction. What I'm going to say is all about this, this, and this. Here it is, this, and this, and this. And then concluding, what I've said is this and this. So it's a bit kind of stylized, but I don't really know any other way. The first question, how you get something published. Don't just send it off into the ether. You need to network and get to know the publishers, ideally the editors and their names, and even try and speak to them about your idea of what you want to produce, because they've got to be with you on the idea. That the first time I tried to publish my research, I was a bit knocked back by other people's comments. What you should do is this, what you should do is that. And I tried those things and it didn't work. I needed to go back to my original nutshell idea. So you need to stick with it and network until you find the right people who want to publish your book or self-publish, which I didn't have much experience on.
I was wondering about the topics of your book. Did you unfold the topics as something that emerged from your passion and interest, or are they things from all the education that you've done are common questions that people ask, and whereabouts with that did you find yourself landing?
The topics are a bit like those spider diagrams. They do come up from what people ask about and problems particularly. And I mean, I think they kind of start from what I think people ought to know, and then they're kind of slightly mollified by not just what people ought to know, but what people actually are interested in. And that's probably why this third book has been produced, because not everybody, although everybody ought to design a forest garden, not everybody has the possibility. So this third book is intended to give a much wider set of people, from gardeners to foresters and foragers, and therapists' ideas about what they could be harvesting or growing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I've learned so much, and I really look forward to the release of your new book. Can you let the listeners know where they can find out about your online courses and where they can find your books and about the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust as well?
Okay, so I will send you the website address for the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust, and welcome visitors who can sign up for an occasional newsletter. We're based in the UK, but there may be a wider European and North American particularly application, hopefully Australia too. I can also include a link to Permanent Publications, the wonderful publishers of my book, who have an online shop. And I guess they will have distributors also elsewhere in the world. So the book is actually advertised already online. It's possible to pre-order.
I did see that. Yes. Fantastic. Wonderful. So we'll put the links in the show notes. And so for everyone who's listening to this, scroll down and have a look at that, and you'll find links to the trust where you can get the books. And maybe, I don't know, I can see if I can include a photograph somehow of that knife that you were talking about. That would be amazing. Where did you actually get that made? I mean, that fascinates me. You know, you designed a knife and got it made. Is there a local knife maker you went to? Or it's kind of an unusual thing.
I think the networking here, it applies. I think I was doing a stall about the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust somewhere and came across a person who made knives. And so I drew it on the back of an envelope, what I wanted. And about 6 months later, came back with a beautiful knife. And there are alternative ways, but maybe we can get the Stobie into mass production.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Oh, thank you so, so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And, I wish you all the best with the release of this new book and with all the things that you're sharing through the Medicinal Forest Garden Trust. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World. Remember, check out the show notes here to find out all the links to Anne's books and also the organizations that she works with. And also check out the notes where you can find details of our permaculture courses, our YouTube, our blog, plus free masterclasses and film clubs. Make sure you're signed up to hear news and updates. And come and join us at the Permaculture Education Institute to learn practical skills for designing and teaching permaculture and making a good livelihood while living a permaculture-inspired one planet way of life. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next time.